Okay, so just a little recap on last week, because you might not have been here, you might have missed a little bit, and so the way this came about was Marty and I were talking about this Advent study by Matt Rawl, and I'm sure many of you have the book, copy here, and I had said, you know, I'd love to do an Advent study for you. He told me about this, and I said, well, what would happen if I took the two of these and kind of tried to mash them together? And that's actually what we idea of trying to blend these two. I feel like I'm losing and coming back, but as long as everybody can hear me, that's all that matters. What I told Marty I would try to do is why the author here of the study takes a more theological approach and more of an Advent-oriented approach. Imagine that, because he's writing an Advent study book, so that's probably a good thing for him to do. But he has some wonderful insights into A Christmas Carol. I know a whole lot about A Christmas Carol because Dickens is one of the people that I've done a lot of work on, presented papers and talks and such like that, published a couple of things on Dickens. So I know a little bit about him. I said, what would happen if I kind of follow A Christmas Carol, the story itself, and go into a fair amount of depth with that, and then drop in along the way some of the insights that Matt Rawl offers? And so that's the goal. And you can judge the success of in terms of meeting that goal on a week-by-week basis. Last week, we had some excellent questions asked at the end. We spent a great time here in Q&A, so save your questions up or just blurt them out along the way. It doesn't matter to me at all. But you may be more familiar at this moment with what Matt Rawl says than you are with what Dickens says in the story. So, but we want to get the two of those geeing and hawing together. Let me recap what we did last week. Last week we focused on the first chapter, the first stave, it's called, the first stanza of Dickens's Carol, and he calls it a carol in prose. So it is like A Christmas Carol in that it has verses and it tells a story and it has a moral to it that is often repeated in a refrain. That's kind of the way a Christmas Carol that we sing works. And so he designed his story that way. And each verse, each stanza, or he uses the archaic word stave, presents a different freestanding part of the story. So last week's was the beginning of the story where Scrooge is haunted by the ghost of his old partner, Marley. And Marley utters this phrase that was extremely significant to the beginning of Scrooge's process of being reborn, where Marley tells him, "I wear the chain I forged in life." The ghost has this enormous chain that is wrapped around him, and Marley tells Scrooge, "I made it myself, link by link, and I wear it of my own free will because those are the choices that I made." And he says to Scrooge, "If you could see yours, you would think mine isn't very big. So, you know, you've got an enormous chain around you. You just can't see it yet." But Marley says, "I've come to warn you. I've come to warn you about the direction your life is heading and that you need to change." Dickens doesn't like to use theological language very much. He's an author of fiction, but if he were inclined to use theological language, he would have had Marley say to Scrooge, "You need to repent. You need to take stock of what you have done with your life, the choices you have made, and repent of those and turn around and move in the opposite direction. So that was what we focused on last week, was with Marley making the warning to Scrooge and telling him he was going to be visited by three spirits. And so we have, in the three remaining weeks of this study, we'll spend 1 week on each of the three spirits, the first being the spirit of Christmas past. This is the very end of chapter one, stave one, where Marley has gone. As Marley is leaving, Scrooge looks out the window and sees that the air is filled with ghosts, all of whom are wearing chains of their own making. And the most heart-wrenching part about those ghosts is that they are all filled with remorse over the way they lived their lives, and they want to try to make amends, but they cannot. The lesson that Marley has told Scrooge is, once you die, you no longer have the power to interact with the world and do anything good for another. And so he sees these spirits trying to do works of kindness and love for others, but they can't. So this change has already started with him. He tried to say humbug, his favorite expression, but he stopped at the first syllable. And then he is so exhausted from the entire ordeal he has been through that day, but especially his glimpse of what Dickens calls the invisible world, that he just collapses into bed. He doesn't change clothes. He falls asleep upon the instant. And that leads us to where we start chapter two, which I've entitled Shadows of the Things That Have Been, which again is a phrase used by the ghost. The first chapter started by setting an atmosphere in London that was dark and cold and foggy and gloomy, and talked about how Scrooge's own personality matched that. So we start in darkness again. And we need to watch anytime Dickens has us moving from darkness to light. Again, he doesn't use theological language, but we recognize those symbols, those codes. You moving from darkness to light is moving out of a state of sinfulness and toward a state of rebirth. For Advent, as Rawl emphasizes, it is very much this light, this movement from darkness to light is one of the themes of Advent. It's why we have our Advent candles, and each week as we get closer to Christmas, the light grows until finally on Christmas Eve we're celebrating with, you know, Joy to the World or Silent Night, and we have our candles, and we have illuminated the entire place. So it starts in darkness again, and Scrooge is awakened by the sound of the clock nearby as it strikes off the four quarters. Bong, 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 bong. And if you've ever listened to those kinds of clocks, you know that what you're waiting for, okay, get through all the bong bongs for the quarter. I want to know what time it is. You know, I want to hear the bong, bong. And the later it is, the longer you have to wait for those. And so there is this incredible tension and drama that's built into this opening scene. And Scrooge listens, and the bell strikes six, and then seven, and then eight, and all the way to 12. Scrooge says, something's wrong. It was past 2 a.m. when Marley and I got finished, when I went to bed, and now it's 12. What has happened? He said, so he searches for explanations. So the clock must be wrong. Maybe there's an icicle stuck in the works and the clock has to be off. He says, but it can't be possible that I slept through an entire day. I couldn't have slept for 24 hours and now it's midnight. Worst case scenario finally occurs to him. He says, maybe it's 12 noon and all the light of the world has been blanked out and it's just all darkness. Scrooge has clearly entered into some kind of time that exists outside of regular time. As we will see when the story is over with, he has the encounters with all three ghosts in the space of a single night, although according to Marley's description, it was supposed to take 3 days for it to happen. So it isn't possible that anything has happened to the sun and that it's 12 at noon. And he says, I've been troubling myself over what Marley's ghost had said. And he comes back to, again, trying to look for a rational explanation, because that's the kind of person Scrooge is. Scrooge deals in tangible things, things that can be touched and counted and weighed. Those are all that have value for Scrooge. Spiritual things don't have value. And in fact, he pretty much dismisses them as not even having reality. And so he says, it must have been a dream, but it doesn't feel like a dream. But it must have been a dream, but it doesn't feel like a dream. So he's left in this state. He knows something has happened, but he's not sure what it is. He lay in this state until the chime had gone 3/4 more, when he remembered that the ghost of Marley had warned him that the first visitor was coming at the toll of 1. So he says, well, I'm going to stay awake then until the clock strikes 1, and when nothing happens, I'll know it was all a dream and it'll all be good. The clock now struck a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy 1, and light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand. And not just any curtains, but the curtains right there by his face. And as the curtains are drawn aside, he finds himself face to face with the unearthly visitor who drew them. I said last week that Dickens uses the words ghost and spirit interchangeably. He calls this a ghost story because it is a little spooky, a little creepy. Scrooge is being haunted, but it's also a spirit story. It's a story in which Scrooge encounters spiritual realities, things that cannot be explained in normal ways, things that can be understood only by faith. And so what's wonderful about this first spirit is the way Dickens describes it. It is the most complicated of the spirits. It is the one that is kind of hardest to nail down because it has so many dimensions to it. It stands for or represents every Christmas that has taken place. So by Scrooge's reckoning, that in 1843, that would be 1843 Christmases that had taken place, give or take a few, depending on how you treat the calendar. But lots of them. The richness, the depth of this first spirit is described in the only way that Dickens knew how to, with words. And he instructed his illustrator not to draw a picture of this spirit because he knew that it couldn't be captured in an illustration. It was a strange figure, it looked like a child, but not so much like a child as like an old man. It seemed to be at the wrong end of a telescope. He said it seemed like when you were looking at it, it always was sort of far away and smaller than it should have been. It had long, long white hair, but not a single wrinkle on its face. The arms were long and muscular. Now remember that detail, because that's going to be significant. And the hands were the same, as if its hold were of uncommon strength. Wore a white tunic, a lustrous belt around it, held a branch of fresh green holly, and then the robe was trimmed with summer flowers. So this strange figure that represents so many different visual symbols, and that the strangest, he says, was that it had a spout of light coming straight up out of its head. If the movement from darkness to light is what Advent is about, and what personal rebirth and redemption are about, then it is symbolized perfectly in this first spirit that Scrooge encounters. And really, the rebirth is accomplished not because of fear, not because of Scrooge is worried about what's going to happen to him. It is encountered by, it is caused by a sense of remorse in seeing how he has failed to be a loving and gracious person. Strangest thing about the spirit, the first spirit, is it's never stable. It says it sparkled and glittered. It fluctuated in terms of its distinctness. At times it seemed to have one arm and then one leg and then 20 legs and now a pair of legs without a head and then a head without a body. And then suddenly it would go back to being itself, distinct and clear as ever. It's hard to know what Dickens intended for us to make out of that. But it seems to me that he's saying that the richness, the wealth of what is symbolized by Christmas is not something that can be captured in a simple way. It has all these different dimensions to it. And it is bigger than any of us can comprehend. Now, this is the only drawing we get in the original, the only one approved by Dickens, and it's at the very end where Scrooge has had more than he can take. He's seen things that have filled him with joy, and he's seen things that have filled him with deep and wrenching sorrow. And to put an end to it, he takes the spirit's cap, which is described as like an extinguisher, a candle snuffer, and smooshes it down on top of the spirit to make him go away. Now, people being the way they are, folks weren't content with the idea that Dickens left us with, that we can't visualize what this first spirit was like. And so people have tried to do that. And I thought it'd be fun to look at a few of those, the way the spirit's been drawn over the years. Here are two really early ones in which the spirit looks very much like a young child, except if you'll notice on the one on the right, look at the right arm that's holding the snuffer. You would not want to arm wrestle with someone with that arm, because though the spirit looks like a child, maybe a young girl, there's this big, beefy, muscular arm on there. So that is one concession to Scrooge's description. I mean, Dickens's description, that the spirit had long, muscular arms and hands. Look, the hands are amazing. All of the depictions have light in them, because that is the defining characteristic of this particular spirit, that Christmas means light in the midst of darkness, that the birth of Christ. And again, I'll remind you, Dickens stays away from most overt expressions of faith or theology. But a light that shines in the darkness ought to be something that we understand and connect with immediately, especially during the Advent season. There again, you have the tiny little child and an arm that looks like it belongs on somebody who is quite a bit bigger, and light coming out of the head. Now, these are illustrations, all of which were done during the 19th century, during the second half of the 19th century, for later editions of the books, of the story. This is an extremely modern one from a cartoon version of it, done where Jim Carrey plays Scrooge, if any of you remember. And though it's not very faithful to the original, it does capture two really important things. One is it's a candle, so by its very nature, it is flame and light. And it does have the snuffer, so that's a good thing, that it keeps the snuffer, because that's an important part, and you don't see the snuffer in lots of the depictions, which makes me wonder, how does Scrooge snuff out the spirit if there's not a snuffer nearby for the hat? Now, the early movie versions were kind of pathetic, to be honest. That Scrooge you see from the back, that's his nightcap, I guess, that he's wearing there. And there's the spirit of Christmas past, who just basically looks like kind of a withered old man. It has very little of the suggestion from the book, from Dickens' own description. It's not quite as far off as this one is, though. So, because of course everybody knows that the spirit of Christmas past was somebody's sweet little old maiden aunt, who carries wears a ribboned hat and carries a mink draped over her arms. That's an exact parallel of the description. This one got a little closer, and notice that we see the spirit as a ghost. We can see through the spirit. But again, the best you could do in those older movies was you put somebody in a costume and that's it. And so you can't have somebody who has one leg and then 20 legs and then no head. That was beyond depiction. Some weird choices got made along the way. Instead of the light coming out the top, this spirit has, you can't see it, but there's a little star perched up on top of the what looked kind of like a nurse's hat, and obviously a young, attractive looking blonde lady. So at the other end of the spectrum, from young, attractive looking blonde lady, we have this depiction. A very ghostly looking, glows all over, has the long hair, has some of the details. This is a fairly current version that starred Patrick Stewart. This one I just don't understand. I mean, the George C. Scott does a good job of being Scrooge, and it's a well-made movie. But for some, I guess it was the period of time when this teasing hair and a lot of hairspray was the thing, So you've got big hair here on the Ghost of Christmas Past, and the big hair seems to have a spotlight shining on it, and that's supposed to be enough to be the light that comes out of this spirit. Same basic mode as the other one, except we do have the snuffer hat. So we're grateful for that. Now we get a little crazy, okay? This I don't know what's going on here. This spirit has tree twigs growing out of the top of her head, and the costume in no way resembles anything that was described to us, but it's not quite as absolutely far-fetched and nightmare-inducing as this one is. Well, what's the point? The point is that we humans, we don't like to leave things alone. We don't like mystery to remain mystery. Dickens has given us this spirit that represents all of Christmas that has happened up until the present, that is the most powerful and most obvious symbol in the entire story of rebirth and redemption, and said, do not try to picture this. And his description is as close as you can come to something that can't be pictured. And what do? We try to depict it. We try to put it in pictures. And I have no idea what was going on here with this one. but it's not quite as strange as this one. This is the last one we're going to look at. You might recognize this spirit from the Trop 50 orange juice commercials. This is from A Christmas Carol, the musical, with Kelsey Grammer. Now, the appearance isn't that strange. We've seen the young, attractive blonde female ghost before. But we haven't seen the spirit dance in a ragged, suggestive costume. I think this is why people complain about musical theater. It's just so many wrong-headed attempts to encapsulate and control the mystery that Dickens has given to us. And that's a familiar thing. In Advent, one of the main thrusts of the season is simply to embrace the mystery rather than trying to understand it. Lead week by week toward what we know is going to be the birth of the Son of God in a manger, you know, the most unlikely place ever. And we simply can't explain it. All we can do is embrace it and accept it. And I think that that's part of what Dickens is trying to get at with this, with the way that he depicts this ghost. It's so important because it is the first of the three. In this particular case, the spirit has come to Scrooge not to talk about the long past, not to talk about how, you know, Christmas ages ago, but to talk about Scrooge's past. In other words, let's look at your life, Scrooge. Let's look at the choices that you have made along the way and where you went off the rails. And the spirit is going to very patiently take Scrooge to visit his past, but not preach at him, not point out to him, see what you're doing there, see, oh, this is a bad choice you made. Scrooge has to come to that awareness all on his own. And it will be an awareness that is like our own coming to faith, sometimes a struggle, sometimes a joyous kind of revelation. Scrooge says, I'm here for your welfare, your reclamation. Might as well have said for your rebirth, because that's what we're going to see is Scrooge reborn. The first place the spirit takes Scrooge is the exact opposite of where we've been up till now in the story. We're not in the city anymore. We're out in the countryside. We're not in the dark. It's broad daylight. we're not shrouded in mist and fog and impossible to see anything. It is bright and clear. And so he transports Scrooge not only to a different time and place, but a different spiritual atmosphere in which he will hopefully be able to see more clearly the things that he has been overlooking. During this very first stop, Dickens points to an amazing fact about us as humans, and I liked what Matt Rawle did with it in his book, because he talks about the fact of Advent being a season of the senses, and especially the role of smell. Dickens says that Scrooge was conscious of 1,000 odors floating in the air, each one connected with 1,000 thoughts and hopes and joys and cares long, long forgotten. And we know that our sense of smell is, in some ways, the most direct sense we have. If you catch a certain kind of smell without even having to think about it, you can be instantly transported to another time and place. How many of you have had that experience? How many of you could even identify that smell? I have a smell that whenever I catch a whiff of it, I am instantly a five-year-old boy again in a lower middle-class suburb in Dallas, where we lived briefly, the only time we weren't in Houston. And I don't even have to think about it. It just takes me there. Now, that's one of my most powerful ones. But the other day, I was going to Kroger, and I was going in to do the grocery shopping, because that's what I do at our house. I do the grocery shopping and the cooking and that kind of stuff. And I walked in. Yeah, see, all you ladies, make a note of that, okay? Guys, yeah. They'd put the Christmas trees out. And I walked in past the Christmas trees, and I caught that smell of the fir tree. Now, we haven't had a live Christmas tree in our house in 30-something years because our son is allergic to them. But I grew up with live trees. I grew up where we went out and would go and find a live tree. Well, I mean, a chopped down live tree, but I mean a tree. A couple of days before Christmas, when there weren't very many left on the lot, and we'd put it on top of the station wagon and drive home and decorate it with all these horrible, gaudy things. And we thought it was wonderful. And that smell is permanently embedded in my memory. Rawle points out the fact that that's what happens during Advent. As all of the smells and the sights and the sounds that we associate with Advent begin to show up shortly after Labor Day. It was much nicer when they waited until after Thanksgiving to do it. But whenever they do, what happens to us? We feel like now it's time for Christmas. My daughter texted me the other day, and she about a week or so back, and she said, "Now I can get ready for Christmas because I saw the first where the little Hershey's Kisses turn into the bells and play the song." She says, "Yeah, that's the beginning of Christmas for me." So we know that about ourselves. Dickens knows that about us as people. So it is not an accident that the very first visit that Scrooge makes to his past, the thing that's going to link him the most solidly to those memories of the past, is smell. And then added to the smell are sights and sounds. Already our crusty old clutching, curmudgeonly, cold, frozen oyster, his lip is trembling, and there's a tear running down his cheek. The mechanism of memory and rebirth has begun. Now, that's a process. It's not like Scrooge just says, hallelujah, you know, I Merry Christmas. It's a long process. It's a journey that he has to take. But it starts in memory. And what's interesting about these memories is the Spirit points out to him, strange that you've forgotten about that all these years. Scrooge said, I know the way. I could walk it blindfolded. Those memories are there. They've made a permanent impression on Scrooge, but something has happened that has covered them over. And so what should have been the informing, guiding spirit of his life, a spirit of joy and community and caring and giving, has been covered over by something else, and Scrooge has to get in and remove that covering and get back to the man that he once was. He recognizes everything, every gate, every post, every tree, and the Spirit has to warn him, this isn't real, and this can't be changed. These are the shadows of the things that have been. This is your past. You're going to see things you did. You're going to feel things you felt that are completely real and honest, and some of them are good and some of them are not so good, but they are you. They're what made you, and you can't change them. So Scrooge can't wipe out his past. He simply has to encounter it and repent of it if he's to be born anew. Scrooge knew and named every one of the people he sees, and then he begins to ask himself, why was he rejoiced beyond all bounds to see them? Why did his cold eye glisten and his heart leap up as they went past? Why was he filled with gladness when he heard them give each other Merry Christmas? Remember that Scrooge had, back in his own time in London, just the day before, has been gripey and grumpy and had all kinds of horrible responses to people who wished him a Merry Christmas. Now, he sees that he wasn't always that way. There was a time when the thought of Christmas gave him great joy. But it's not just joy, because Scrooge was apparently also a very sad young man. A solitary child neglected by his friends is left there still in the school. Everybody else has left, and Scrooge is still there. And Scrooge was so lonely as a boy, he had to live in his imagination. He would read, and the characters of the stories would become real to him, and that was how he got by, was making a fantasy world in which things, life was better than the life that he was actually experiencing as a young child. And we find him now making a characteristic move, something that he has experienced in the memory makes him regret what he did in real life and wish that he could change it. And the Spirit notices something, you know, that Scrooge is getting kind of, you know, misty again. He said, you know, what's the matter? I left all that out. He said, you know, what's the matter? Well, nothing. Well, what's really the matter? Well, I wish, it's too late now. Well, what is it? He said, there was a boy singing a Christmas carol at my door last night. I should like to have given him something. That's all. It's too late. It's too late to go back and change that moment of the past. But the message isn't that it's too late, because this is in the past. These are the shadows of things that have been. The message of A Christmas Carol is you have another chance. The message is it is an Advent message. It is a message of hope and moving forward and the possibility to change who you are. And we will see Scrooge with each of these encounters weigh out what he did versus what he wishes he had done. And that is finally what creates this change in him. we have an account where his sister comes and greets him, and we find out some facts about Scrooge's boyhood, that his father was cruel to them, and the father sent Scrooge away to boarding school and didn't want to see him around anymore. And then his sister shows up and says, "Something's happened. Father is so much kinder than he used to be. Home is like heaven." And I asked him if you could come home, and he said, "Yes, you can." He said, "You're to be a man and never come back here again." And we're going to start this new chapter of our life off by spending all of Christmas together and have the merriest time in all the world. So we discover that Scrooge has a lot to be sad about. Scrooge had a lot of things happen to him that could easily be responsible for having turned him into the man he becomes. He makes his own choices, but we can understand why he made some of those choices. Now, the part of Christmas past that everybody knows and everybody's familiar with is the party at Fezziwig's. Scrooge was an apprentice at Fezziwig's counting house. That's where he learned the business. And he had in Fezziwig a role model of what a generous, loving Christian man should be. Not only filled with joy, but filled with generosity. And yet, Scrooge turned away from that role model. We're told that Fezziwig laughed all over himself, from his shoes to his organ of benevolence. That's up here. And he called out in a comfortable, oily, rich, fat, jovial voice, "Yo-ho there, Ebenezer! Dick, yo-ho, my boys! Christmas Eve, Christmas! Let's celebrate! Let's clear away all the work tables, and we're going to have a party. We're going to feast. We're going to dance. We're going to celebrate the birth of Christ in a way that is fitting and that is ultimately more important than our work." That's just a funny line. Where Fezziwig, though he is an old man, apparently can really cut a rug. And British men were very vain about their calves. You know, they liked to wear, during this period, they wore those short pants that gathered just below the knees, and then high socks, and that would show off their calves. And Fezziwig's calves are so nice that it says, you know, light seemed to issue from Fezziwig's calves. They shone in every part of the dance like moons. Okay, so Fezziwig not only is joyful in his spirit, but he radiates light. I wonder if Dickens is trying to get to us here somehow, trying to get a message through to us. Young Ebenezer lived in the presence of joy and light. And he knew it, but he somehow chose to go beyond it. The ghost plays a little mean trick on him. He kind of baits him, and he says, they've been listening to young Ebenezer and young Dick praising Fezziwig's generosity. And the spirit says, "Oh, he only spent a few pounds on it. Does he really deserve that much praise? I mean, from a monetary standpoint, this really wasn't a very big sacrifice, but you're acting like he just, you know, like he did everything. It's a small matter to make these silly folks so full of gratitude." Scrooge, at these moments, begins to speak, the story tells us, like his old self. Those old, good, generous, caring values are still in there. They've just been buried very deep. "Small," echoed Scrooge. "Well, he only spent a few pounds. Is that so much that he deserves this praise?" And Scrooge says, "It isn't that. He has the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome, a pleasure or a toil. Say that his power lies in words and looks, in things so slight and insignificant that it is impossible to add and count them up. What then? In other words, maybe it is something that a quality that can't be measured and counted, the stuff I deal with every day, the stuff I have made so valuable in my life. Does that make it any less valuable just because it's only in his words or his looks? The happiness he gives is quite as great as if it cost a fortune. Now, modern day Scrooge would never talk that way. That's not the Scrooge we saw in the beginning of the story. He is already thinking and talking and feeling in accordance with his deeply buried values, and they're beginning to percolate up to the surface a little bit. And again, we have one of those moments where Scrooge gets kind of emotional and the spirit says, "What's the matter?" You know, "Nothing, something, I think. I just would like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk just now." He remembers how Fezziwig treated him as an apprentice, and then he remembers how he treats Bob Cratchit as his clerk. And he shows signs of genuine remorse. The change is beginning to happen, but it's not just like our own movement toward a life of faith. It's not steady and always in a single direction. It sometimes kind of wanders from place to place. We got a little bit of time. Come on. See Fezziwig's calves there? There's young Ebenezer with the young lady that he loves, Nell. They met and fell in love when they were both poor, and they felt like they could, that love was enough, that they could get by, and they would always be faithful to each other. But we find out that Scrooge has changed. Now, those are not the words that Dickens wrote. They add a little bit of their own text here. But the point is the same. In this last and powerful encounter that Scrooge has with his own past, there are actually two scenes with Nell. He's torn between, he's drawn toward the man he was in the past, and yet he knows and still is the man he is in the present. And he's torn between those two selves. He's in a process of changing, a process of being reborn, but it hasn't happened all the way yet. And so he still is leaning more toward his present self, his hard, cold, greedy self. And his explanation is, the world changed. What he will find out through the rest of his journey is that it's not the world that changed. It's he that changed. And that it is still possible to have Christ-like values in the world where he lives, and that they are still modeled around him constantly. We'll see some of those role models next week when the Ghost of Christmas Present takes him around various places in London and England and beyond even, to see that the spirit of Christmas is alive and well everywhere he turns. And if he will just open his eyes and his mind and his heart to them and invite that spirit in, that he will be himself transformed and reborn. Okay, questions. We've got a couple of minutes of official time left, and then those of you who don't have to scurry off right away, I'll stay as long as you like to answer any questions. Yes, sir. No, that is that the church has two major winter holidays, Christmas and Epiphany, and they're 12 days apart. And so Epiphany really is an older holiday than Christmas, and Epiphany was, so legend, tradition said, was on the day that the wise men arrived to bring their gifts to the baby Jesus, on January the 6th. The setting of the Christmas celebration on December 25th was actually the borrowing of a date that was from a secular holiday, a very old secular winter holiday, and the church adopted that and kind of baptized it and said, well, we're going to celebrate the birth of Jesus. Let's celebrate it on the December 25th. And in doing so, they created that 12-day span between Christmas and Epiphany. And so as time went by, the celebration of Christmas, instead of being a single holy day on the calendar, stretched into the time span between those two very important holy days. Right. The 12 days have never caught on very good in America. We like to do our celebrating the 30 days ahead of time, you know, basically. And then we're exhausted by the time the 25th gets here, and people are saying, I'm sick of the lights and the tree and all this kind of stuff. Let's clean things up and put the house back to normal again. You know, that's more the American spirit. In England and countries that had their origin from England, the 12 days are still celebrated very much. There's a gift given each day. There are special celebrations associated with them. We have a couple of those left, like the 26th is Boxing Day. We don't necessarily call it Boxing Day, but that was when you take the leftovers from your feast and you put them in boxes and you go and take them to the poor. So, but that was just, you know, the most we know about the 12 days is the song, you know, usually. That's about as far as we get. What else? Yes, sir.
Right. Don't waste your time.
That's the Henry Winkler one, right? Oh, I think I've seen that one, yeah.
Rated 1.5 stars, and I'm still trying to get that 1.5. I missed Christmas present. I'm sorry, I missed Christmas past. A spirit past. Spirit present was the lead singer for Meatloaf.
Oh, lovely. Okay, well, like, you know, This story is so incredibly popular, people can't leave it alone. They remake it, they retell it, they modernize it, they ruin it. You know, it just depends on different choices that they get made. If they can at least get the heart of the story, that it's about rebirth, it's about repentance and rebirth, then I'll be happy with that, although I don't know about Meatloaf, you know. So, what else? Don't be bashful. No, I did such a great job of explaining everything that there are no questions left. Thank you. Please come back next week, and because we get to talk about the spirit that everybody knows what he looks like, the giant wearing the green outfit and with the feast spread all around him. And so that'll be a lot of fun. We have books up here if you're interested. Like Marty said, the Two Things of Mine. And if you don't have a Matt Rawl study book yet, we have copies of that up here as well.